How do we forget how to play? Because we were once children. How do we lose that?
Hey, this is Sherry Gregory, and you're listening to Grit and Grace, Good Girls Breaking Bad Rules. Today, my delightful co-host, Amy Carroll, and I are talking with Lucille Zimmerman, licensed professional counselor and author of Renewed, Finding Your Inner Happy in an Overwhelming World. We're discussing the importance of play, grieving, and forgiveness. Why do you think that those of us who are recovering perfectionists, people pleasers, and those of us who are HSPs, why might we have a hard time with play?
Well, Sherry, I'm going to go ahead and just start off with the reason I wrote my book. And that was when I was going through my counseling program. It was intense. And it was intense academically, and it was intense as I had to rework through a lot of my own life history and issues. Because a lot of counseling programs believe that unless you deal with your stuff, you're not going to be effective for anyone. And so I kept hearing this from mentors and counselors, and they kept saying, you need to do self-care. And I kept saying, what is self-care? I have no idea what that is. And I was an absolute ultra perfectionist. You know, I feel like I looked the part, I acted the part, I always had a smile on my face. One of the first times I went in to talk with the director of the counseling program, I just had this big smile on my face, and he's like, have a seat, you know, tell me about your life. And I was like, it's good, it was all good, perfect life. And he started to laugh. It's so funny now because he saw right through me. As the years went on, I did come to understand what self-care was, and self-care is really different for a lot of people, you know, what helps us and what heals us. But play, I think, is critical for everybody. It's hard to describe what play is. Have you guys heard of the word flow?
Yeah.
From Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi. He says that flow is whenever we're doing an activity where we lose track of time, and yet it's challenging, and it's sort of where we're gifted, or we have a zeal for that area. And so in that sense, I think it is similar to flow. You asked me why play is hard for perfectionists and people pleasers, and I think it's because our culture really values exhaustion and working. It's like a status symbol. And so to ever take a break would be crazy for our culture to look at.
Absolutely. I think back to the days when I was mothering young children, and that's the time that we should play. I had a friend I was so jealous of. I would watch her play with her children, and she was so good at playing, and I was so bad at playing. And what's up with that?
God biologically programmed us to need to play. All animals play, babies play, children play. You're right, we lose it. And I think it's critical for our creativity and our being able to come up with good ideas. And, you know, the brain is so interesting because a totally different part of the brain comes online when we're playing as when we're working. And so we need that downtime. And I'm sure you guys have all had this experience of having your best ideas when you're gardening or taking a shower or jogging. And it's because our brains actually open up and become broader. They think better when we're playing.
I'm just thinking to myself how guilty I used to feel, and I still have to kind of battle this sense of guilt. I have to talk myself out of it, that I would stop working and stop producing and just do this, what feels like wasteful activity that I have nothing to show for afterwards. I can feel myself getting anxious just thinking about it. What are a couple of your favorite things to do that you would qualify as play?
For me, and this is going to sound silly, you know, these little succulent plants that you see everywhere? Well, one day I just decided to go to the garden center and pick out a few plants. They were like $2 a piece, so I got three or four, and I bought some desert potting soil and just a little dish. And it was so easy to put together. And then, I bought a pack of moss and just covered it. It took like 5 minutes, and it gave me such a thrill inside. It was creative. It was life-giving. And then I started making them for friends. Another thing I love to do is on Animoto, the program Animoto, I love to just take pictures and put it with some of my favorite songs. Another way I love to play would just be hiking or reading or being in nature. So what are the ways you guys love to play?
The thing that gets me in a play mode is my pets. because they're just so kooky and they make me laugh so much. I could spend hours doing the laser pointer thing with either one of our cats, and they just make me laugh so hard. And I lose track of time, which I think is part of play, that we aren't on a timer and we aren't on a schedule. I feel good afterwards. How about you, Amy?
Well, I love being outside like Lucille. I love to walk in the woods and things like that. I don't do it nearly often enough is what I'm realizing it even as I say it. And I also love to decorate. It's just one of those creative outlets. So painting a room or going shopping at Home Goods, those are at the top of my list. But I love it, Lucille, that I think that we in our culture would define play and productivity as opposites. Right. And what you're saying is they're not opposites. At all.
No. And I have the perfect quote by Brian Sutton Smith, and he says, "The opposite of play isn't work, it's depression."
Let's go ahead and shift topics from play, which many of us have no idea how to do well, to something else really important that a lot of us also struggle with: grieving. If I could go back in time and pick a class to take in elementary and high school, I would find a grief class, because it seems to be the thing that's guaranteed in this life that, I don't know about you ladies, but I don't feel like I was taught how to do it or had it modeled for me. So what happens to any of us if we act like we can just avoid grieving?
Well, first of all, I'm so glad that you're talking about this. It's a huge issue, and our Western culture really doesn't do a very good job of letting people grieve. And I know there have been times in my life where I wished I had a cave that I could just go in and cry and scream, but our culture doesn't offer that. And I know you've probably heard about the Jewish culture, how they have what they call sitting Shiva, and for 7 days people would just gather and be with the person who's grieving. They don't necessarily talk, they're just with them. And I think we're missing that, but I love this quote. It says that grief is not a problem to be solved. It just means that you loved somebody. Mm. If we bury our emotions, we bury them alive, and they wait. Grief waits. When I lost my mom when I was 18, I just pushed it down and put on the smile and tried to go through life. But pain is pain. I just think that humans are so creative in the ways that it leaks out, leak out in workaholism or in substance abuse, so many different ways. We need to grieve. And one of the most helpful ways I ever found to grieve my mom was I had made her like a saint. So one thing I did was I just made a collage, and on the right side, I tore out magazine pictures or images that I printed off the internet and wrote words that were descriptive of her, all her good traits. But then on the left, I had to do her faults. And that was a way for me to kind of accept who she was and to help. I don't know. It was weird how it helped me to, not forget about her for certain, but to let her, I guess, rest. So that was one of the best ways I learned to grieve. Another way would be journaling and writing letters, even if you're mad or sad. Oh, and this is a huge point with grief. There's the grief, sad part, but another huge aspect to grief is the anger, because it's the line in the sand that says, this is not okay that you lost your mom so young or whatever. Women tend to do sadness and sorrow, but we don't tend to do the anger part. That's important.
I coined the word for myself, angrief, after my mom died. I was completely unprepared for how angry I was, because she and I weren't particularly close ever. Right. And I thought losing her wasn't going to be particularly difficult. And I found myself pretty much angry at everybody and everything, and pretty much had to put up a warning sign for 3 months.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because there's something called complicated grief. And that's when you have to work through, like, why wasn't she what I needed her to be? Or why, whatever it was, there is that anger and there is that boundary saying things weren't as they should have been.
I think what both of you are expressing is just the unexpected parts of grief. And I think as a perfectionist, I don't like the unexpected. I liked the planned and the controlled. And my mom has worked in hospice care and end of life care for decades. And yet when she lost her mother and her brother within a year, she said, even though I've studied grief and I've helped other families with grief, it came in such unexpected ways. What are some of the unexpected things that you experienced in your grief?
For me, you know, I could be going along just having a perfectly good day, and I might just see something that reminds me of my mom, or smell a certain smell, or hear a song. And songs are really powerful, aren't they? They take us back. How about you, Sherry, with your mom?
Probably the most surprising thing for me is jealousy, seeing other people who still have their mother, you know, mothers and daughters laughing together. And I've had to really talk myself down and realize that, you know, it's okay to have a longing, but to feel the level of outright envy that I find myself in, and then needing to pull back and practice some of that self-care that we talked about earlier. Because for me, my tendency as a perfectionist is to shame myself. How can you? How dare you? How can you look at a beautiful mother and daughter having a beautiful relationship and have this terrible reaction and then work myself to death as a punishment?
I think that's so normal. And grief takes up so much headspace, doesn't it? It's hard to even go to the grocery store or to get gas. It's so hard. And so we do need to be graceful to ourselves. And I like to say mother ourselves and talk to ourselves like, you know what? It's horrible that you lost her and that things weren't right. I feel so sad for you and I feel so sorry for you right now. And it's going to be okay. We're going to get through this. It's like almost like I'm talking from a motherly part of myself to myself.
God's had me on a journey of what I've called remothering for the last couple of years. And just listening to you, I'm tearing up because that's what we need so much, is that kind of compassion and that kind of tenderness with ourselves. I don't think I've ever behaved better because I beat myself up.
Absolutely.
Well, and it's neat because I think about that self-mothering that you're talking about, and that really extends. I'm thinking, I haven't lost my parents like you all have, but I had a period of infertility, and there, it's that same grieving. I think about my friends who are single that would love to be married, and there's a grief that comes with that too. And so the things that you all are talking about really can extend in so many directions in a woman's life.
For sure. You're right. I'm so glad you said that, because we don't have to have someone die to grieve something.
Well, I think we can kind of segue here into forgiveness. I think grief and forgiveness have a lot in common, or sometimes grief lasts longer than it needs to because there's a lack of forgiveness. I discovered about 4 years ago that my mother was depressed my entire life. And although that was very difficult to learn, it absolutely opened the door for forgiveness, because I realized for the first time that we were on the same side. We both spent our entire lives fighting perfectionism. And the only way she won was by losing her memory to Alzheimer's disease. And she fortunately became very calm and relaxed and completely non-anxious and non-perfectionistic. I do wish that I could have had some conversations with her earlier on when she still was in her full mind and memory. I would love to have talked to her about her wrestling with perfectionism and people-pleasing and that sort of thing. Let's talk a little bit about forgiveness and why it might be that those of us who wrestle with perfectionism and people-pleasing find it especially hard to forgive.
Well, I think you just nailed it when you said grief and forgiveness. They do go hand in hand, some of us more than others. For me, when I lost my mom, I was a teenager. There was a lot going on in addition to that, a lot of trauma. And so I turned to guys and booze and drugs and really acted out. And then my mom died. And I had a really hard time later on as a people pleaser perfectionist saying, why wasn't I a better teenager? Why wasn't I there for her? And a couple things helped me to forgive myself. I had to tell my story, and our family wasn't one that ever, you know, shared our story or talked about emotions. And so it wasn't until I was 37 that I had to share my story, but I also had to do it with someone human. For so many years, I would sit in my bedroom and pray and cry and be ashamed. But one thing I've learned is that we get hurt in our real life relationships. And so it's in our real life relationships that we heal. And so I needed a human to stand in and sort of be that Christ for me and share my story. And I needed to share all of it, the dark and the dirty, and have someone reflect love back to me. And that really was healing. My whole life, I thought I was just going to live with shame forever. But it went away. And it was shocking how it went away. And then another part of this is being able to just see the good and the bad. Mm. And I've realized that the healthiest people, they don't see themselves as all good or all bad. They see themselves as a conglomeration of that.
That's actually really helpful. I remember reading in Renewed that one of the difficulties for perfectionists is as soon as we make a mistake, we then see ourselves as all bad. It's that black yes. and white, all or nothing thinking.
Yes.
And learning to live with the tension of being this combination of both is difficult, but so important.
You know, one of my favorite professors, I would walk in and he would just be goofy and he'd say, "Oh, I'm in my 50s and I have issues," or, you know, he would just share his flaws. And I realized I was so drawn to him because of his goofiness and silliness and imperfection. And I know you guys know about Brené Brown. She says perfectionism really is, it's like a 2-ton wall of armor. We're in hiding when we're in perfection.
Yeah.
So it's really the opposite of connection, which is what we all need.
Anything that you have as a kind of a closing message to the women who are listening?
I had the experience when I was finished up with my counseling program and working in internships. I worked at one site where it was homeless, indigent people. And then I worked at another site where it was probably the wealthiest church in our city, mm-hmm. where women were dropping off their preschoolers with their Gucci's mm-hmm. and their high heels.
My words.
And I was so intimidated by people who looked the part, you know. And then I started working in that counseling center and I realized everybody's the same. Mm. They're just dressed differently. And so if there is somebody out there who's thinking I could never share my story or tell my secrets or whatever, that is the key to healing, is to finding one person that is safe, that you can tell your entire story to.
Oftentimes, the safest person is going to be someone like you who's a counselor. Many of us have family members who can hear parts, but that,
right.
for whom they're either not safe or they're not equipped to hear the whole thing.
And it's amazing what just one little thing a counselor can say that can be helpful. Years ago, I went to see a counselor because I was so sad my daughter was going away to college. And all this counselor said to me that was helpful, she said, "Lucille, the first child leaving home is a monumental experience. Everybody's feeling it. It's just nobody's talking about it." And that helped me so much. So yes, counseling can be a gift.
Thank you so much, Lucille.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Lucille.
Two separate but related bad rules emerged from this episode. The first one is play is slacking. And the second one, grief is nothing but a pity party. Well, the truth is that both play and grief are essential to living a full life. They both serve as powerful tools for creativity and for healing. On the webpage for today's episode, you'll find links to some great resources from Lucille, and you can enter our giveaway for her book, Renewed. You'll find the webpage at sherrygregory.com. That's sherrygregory.com. We hope you've enjoyed episode number 16 of Grit and Grace, Good Girls Breaking Bad Rules. Next week, Amy and I will share how we've been applying what we learned from Lucille about play, grieving, and forgiveness to our everyday lives. For today, grow your grit, embrace God's grace, and when you run across a bad rule, go right on ahead and break it.